This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I think what I want to do is talk a little bit about the history of SCID and give you a sense of how some of the advances that have been made for treating many other diseases have in fact originated with some of the things that we've learned about severe combined immunodeficiency over the years. We'll also talk about the diagnosis and some of the clinical manifestations, and then I'll give you an update, the most recent update, I think, on therapy for severe combined immunodeficiency, and then talk about newborn screening, which I think is very exciting. So those are my disclosures. And nothing that I'll talk about today would be in conflict with that. So just in terms of some of the early history of SCID, in 1950, human severe combined immunodeficiency was first reported, and it was called Swiss agammaglobulinemia. So this is when the story began. In 1968, so it was 18 years later, was the first successful non-twin bone marrow transplant, and that was done by Robert Good at Minnesota, and that was for severe combined immunodeficiency, and it was really that experience that led the way to transplant for leukemia and other diseases. In 1969 was, of course, everybody remembers, the first landing on the moon, and NASA became a household name. And then 2 years later, David Vetter was born, and this was the bubble boy. He had X-SCID, and he was born into a sterile environment that was, in fact, manufactured or created by NASA in Texas. And, of course, then the movie came out in 1976, and this was when John Travolta actually became famous. This was, I think, his first movie, or certainly his first successful movie. 1972 was the first discovered molecular cause of SCID, and that was adenosine deaminase deficiency. And then 77, because of work on trying to understand the pathogenesis of SCID and to develop an animal model, pentostatin was discovered. And that actually is a drug that we use today, not only for cancer therapy, but for treating patients with graft versus host disease following allogeneic bone marrow transplantation. 1979 was the first successful T-cell depleted mismatched transplant, and that was for SCID again. And that now, haplocompatible transplantation is something that is being used more and more for patients who don't have very good matched donors for a whole variety of diseases today. And then in 2002 was the first truly successful gene therapy, and that was reported for adenosine deaminase deficient SCID, and then subsequently for the X-linked form of SCID. So what about the clinical manifestations? This is clearly the most severe form of primary immune deficiency, in that there's no T cells or B cell function in these patients. There's two types of inheritance. There's the X-linked form. There's the autosomal recessive inheritance. And these patients present, this says typically, but I would say the classical form of SCID, this is before newborn screening, these patients would present usually within the first 6 months of life with a whole variety of symptoms, infections, failure to thrive, skin rashes, draining otitis media, candida infection, and so forth, and really would have a whole variety of infections, pneumonias, and so forth. At least in California and other states that are doing newborn screening, I think we're now, you know, we don't see this as much anymore, but this is certainly the way these patients can present if they're not diagnosed early. There are two other related forms of SCID. I'm not going to spend really too much time on them, but one is reticular dysgenesis, which is associated with sensorineural hearing loss and pancytopenia, and Omenn syndrome, which is a form of leaky SCID in which these patients present with activated T cells that develop rashes, hepatosplenomegaly, lymphadenopathy, eosinophilia, and elevated IgE. The overall incidence today, and I'll show you the data where that comes from, is 1 per 58,000 live births, about twice as frequent as what we used to think the incidence was. And these patients, without either a transplant, without enzyme replacement therapy, without gene therapy, will die, usually within the first year of life. So in terms of the laboratory diagnosis, I've just broken it down into the types of cells affected, the T cells, the B cells, and the NK cells, and then this typical form of SCID. And these patients with the typical SCID have very low T cell numbers, less than 300, and their function, their in vitro proliferation of T cells to a mitogen called phytohemagglutinin, or PHA, is usually very low, less than 10% of the lower limit of normal. It's interesting and almost you expected that about 40 to 60% of these patients, in fact, will have maternal engraftment. They will have identifiable maternal T cells in their blood at the time of diagnosis. In those cases, then the CD3 count actually may be a little higher than 300, although not usually, and the PHA may have some function. Again, it's generally very low, but it can be some low level of function. The Omenn and the leaky SCID can have even up to normal numbers of CD3 cells and certainly function that is greater than 10%. These are usually associated with hypomorphic mutations in primarily the recombinase activating genes, but some of the other genetic causes of SCID can also present as an Omenn syndrome. They have very high numbers of memory T cells, but very few naive T cells, and they generally don't have any identifiable maternal cells at the time of diagnosis. And reticular dysgenesis, again, often will have the same laboratory findings as typical SCID. The additional finding is that these are the babies that will present in the nursery with sepsis and a white count of zero. And then the B cells, of course, in patients with SCID may be present, but and their immunoglobulins are generally low, but they can be normal. But the bottom line is that there's no antibody production. They don't make specific antibodies. And natural killer cells may be present with normal function, or they may be absent in children with SCID. So just looking at the types of SCID and the genetic causes, I've just broken it down into three categories: those involved with DNA synthesis or DNA metabolism, and adenosine deaminase, or ADA, is the best example there. And the phenotype in those patients is typically a T-, B-, NK-, meaning that these patients basically don't have any lymphocytes or very low numbers of lymphocytes. Their lymphocyte counts is often 1 or 200. And then there is a category of T cell activation and signal transduction defects. And you see here there's a variety of potential causes. The phenotype in the ones involving the T cell receptors or ligands is an absence of T cells but presence of B cells and natural killer cells. And then there's the kinase or activation pathway defects, and the most common cause is the X-linked form here, which is the interleukin common gamma chain receptor, which is defective or deficient in patients with that disease. And then JAK3 is another form that is autosomal recessive, but that they both have this phenotype, that is absent T cells and absent NK cells, but the presence of normal numbers of B cells. And then finally, there are the defects involving the immunoglobulin and T cell receptor generation during VDJ recombination. And these are the patients that have absent T and absent B cells, but they have normal numbers of NK cells. And there's two categories. One is just affected, in which only VDJ recombination is affected, and that's the recombinase activating genes, either number one or number two. And then the other category affects not only VDJ recombination, but also the DNA repair pathway. And there's a variety of genes that are affected or that can cause that phenotype and severe combined immunodeficiency disease. So what about transplantation for these patients? So the rationale is the same as pretty much any non-malignant disorder or marrow cell defect. That is, you want to replace the defective stem cells in the bone marrow with cells from a normal, healthy donor. So for most diseases, not SCID, but for most diseases, you have to accomplish two goals. One is you have to make space or open up niches in the marrow for the donor cells to engraft, and then you have to prevent rejection of the donor cells. To make space, the most common drug used is high-dose busulfan, but also melphalan and sometimes thiotepa have been used. And in order to prevent rejection, high-dose cyclophosphamide or fludarabine are commonly used. Now, for severe combined immunodeficiency disease, there are two distinct, and I would say even today, controversial approaches. So there are clearly the people who favor high-dose chemotherapy for these patients, just as you would treat a patient with leukemia getting an allogeneic bone marrow transplant. And it's true that if you do treat these patients with high-dose chemotherapy, they will engraft with donor T cells. And in most patients, but not all, they'll also get B cell reconstitution, which is, of course, the goal for transplantation for these patients. If you give the alternative approach, which is minimal to no chemotherapy, in most cases you'll get donor T cell reconstitution, but often you won't get B cell recovery. So these patients will be cured of their T cell defect, but will require supplementation with immunoglobulin therapy in order to manage the B cell defect. So the issue is B cell reconstitution versus the morbidity and mortality associated with exposing young babies to high-dose chemotherapy. This is especially an issue, and I'll show you the data to support this, in patients with active viral infections at the time of transplant. Maybe that's a little bit going to be less of an issue today, now that we have newborn screening and can diagnose these children prior to them getting infected. But then you have to deal with newborns who are maybe 1 or 2 months old because of newborn screening or positive family history, exposing them to the high-dose chemotherapy. So I would have to say this has been unresolved to date, although I'll show you some data that I think we generated that has at least brought this a little bit closer to a resolution. So what about the donors? This is just an example here of the inheritance patterns, and I'll try to go through this quickly for the sake of time, but basically we're looking for histocompatibility between the donor and the recipient. And there are 12 genes that are the major HLA genes that we try to match for. There are 6 maternal and 6 paternal. In this example, I'm only showing as an example just 3 on each side But you can imagine them, the rest of them down here as well, because they're all on chromosome 6. The only difference is that the DP gene is so far away from the other genes that it tends to segregate independently with inheritance. In this example, you have the maternal haplotype here being given to the patient or inherited by the patient, and then you have this haplotype from the father in the patient. In this example, or in this sibling, this sibling got the same maternal haplotype as the patient, but got the opposite paternal haplotype. So this sibling is half-matched or haplocompatible, and by definition, every parent, every biologic parent, is going to be half-matched or haplocompatible with their child. In this example, or in this patient, this sibling, rather, inherited the same haplotypes from the mother and from the father as the patient. So this sibling, and there's basically a 25% chance of that happening, is a what we would call a genotypic matched or HLA matched sibling. And this is really our gold standard for allogeneic transplantation. But if the matched sibling is not available, then we have three alternatives. So one that I'm sure you've already heard a lot about is the haplocompatible related donor, typically a parent, but it could be a haplocompatible sibling, or we've used grandparents or cousins or uncles or aunts as well. But to use these types of donors safely, one has to do T-cell depletion in order to avoid graft versus host disease, which is a very serious complication, potentially serious complication of transplantation. It's mediated by donor T-cells, and depending on the degree of mismatch, can have a mortality as high as 15 to 20%. These patients may need some conditioning, especially in NK-positive severe combined immunodeficiency, because NK cells are capable of rejecting mismatched donor grafts. And some of these patients may have inadequate or incomplete T-cell reconstitution and no B-cell reconstitution without conditioning. Then there's the HLA-matched, unrelated volunteer adult donor. One of the big issues for them, using them, is that the average time to find such a donor is 3 months. So when you have a child with SCID, there's a sense of urgency to try to get a graft into them to begin T-cell reconstitution before they get infected. Typically, high-dose chemotherapy has been used when unrelated donors are used. And although we have some data that we've recently published that this may not be necessary, but there is a high risk of graft versus host disease when unrelated adult donors are used. And then there's the cord blood donor, in which generally high-dose chemotherapy is needed for these transplants. There's increased rejection even with chemotherapy, although probably not to the same extent with SCID as with other non-SCID disorders. There's still a risk of graft versus host disease because generally we're not using perfectly matched unrelated cord bloods. We're using mismatched cord bloods. And of course, once you've used those cells, there are no cells left over, so you can't go back to that donor to get any additional cells if you want to try to boost the transplant. So SCID has been hard to study. Most centers will see at most maybe one or two patients per year. There are no standard protocols for treating SCID, and therefore each center has developed their own approach and their own way of doing it. It's difficult to write protocols for SCID at a center and getting IRB approval just for one patient. So in 2007 and 2008, we organized two NIH conferences on primary immune deficiency, and this resulted in a grant application to the Office of Rare Disease Research for a U54 consortium grant, which was part of the Rare Disease Clinical Research Network, number two. And we were fortunately funded starting in 2009, and we actually just got our renewal this past September for another 5 years. We added one more center to the 43, so we now have 44 centers in the U.S. and Canada, and we have 3 centers in Europe. We have a steering committee, we have an external advisory committee, scientific planning committee, and 5 patient advocacy groups that are involved in this consortium. This just shows you, this shows you the just the distribution of the centers all over the United States, plus in Canada, and then we have the 3 centers in Europe. The major objectives of the PIDTC is to characterize the long-term outcomes and late effects in children with 3 different primary immune deficiencies: SCID, Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, and chronic granulomatous disease. We want to try to define critical factors and biologic markers that predict outcome for these disorders. Our goal is to ultimately capture the majority, if not all, of the children diagnosed in the U.S. with a severe combined immunodeficiency disease. We have a program for training fellows and junior faculty, and of course we want to try to disseminate information about what we find. These are the 4 protocols that are active now. One is a prospective study of babies or children with severe combined immunodeficiency disease. We have also a retrospective and cross-sectional study, and we've just put together a database of 740 children with SCID who were diagnosed between 1968 and 2012, and we're in the process of analyzing that data set. And I think there's going to be a lot of information over the next year and a half that will come out based on this study. We also have a study on chronic granulomatous disease and one on Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome. So what are the questions that we were trying to address in 2014 to 2015? Well, the big interest has been a newborn screening, and we're now, I think in the United States, screening more than 60% of all newborns. There are 23 states. Every time I update this, it gets out of date very quickly. So there's at least 23 states and the Navajo Nation that are screening. And with this, I think it's possible to identify and cure all babies with severe combined immunodeficiency disease. So the questions that we had that we wanted to try to answer were: what's the best alternative donor type when a matched sibling is not available? What's the best approach for the SCID patient identified at birth? What's the best approach for a patient with active infection? And should conditioning be used to promote B-cell engraftment? So this is a paper that came out this year in the New England Journal of Medicine, summarizing a study that we did where we just looked at the most recent decade between 2000 and through 2009 with at least a 2-year follow-up. But in fact, we actually went to a 5-year. We were able to look at data with 5-year follow-up. So this was a retrospective review of 240 patients. We just looked at those with the typical or classic type of SCID and transplanted at PIDTC centers. So this is a sub-cohort of this 740 that I mentioned earlier. So all cases were centrally reviewed for eligibility according to the criteria that we established, and I've already given that to you. We excluded the patients with leaky SCID or Omenn syndrome or reticular dysgenesis or patients with ADA SCID getting enzyme replacement or gene therapy. The information about those patients will come later. this, hopefully by in 2015. And then we had, everything was captured in an electronic database and analyzed. So the overall survival in this cohort was 74%. We wanted to ask questions about the age and what was the effect of age and active infection at the time of transplant, what was the effect of donor type, and what was the effect of conditioning, either nothing versus immunosuppression, reduced intensity conditioning, or myeloablative conditioning. And then we also had 149 patients who had survived beyond 2 years post-transplant, and we wanted to look at immune outcome. So we defined T-cell recovery as a CD3 count greater than 1,000, and B-cell recovery as freedom from immunoglobulin replacement. So what is the role of donor type and then conditioning in also in immune in the immune outcome, whether we were getting T and or B cell reconstitution? So I'll just show you four slides that kind of summarize the gist of the data that we found. But there's a lot more that we did report in this paper. So what about active infection and age? How did that affect five-year survival? So what you can see is that babies that were transplanted for SCID who were under 3.5 months of age had clearly the best survival, 94%. If they were older and they had had an infection, but the infection resolved at the time of transplant, or if they were older and they had no infection, then these patients all seemed to do pretty well. I mean, it did drop off a little bit to 82%, but this was not statistically significant. However, in the group, this older group that had active infection at the time of transplant had a significantly poorer outcome of 50% chance of survival at 5 years. What about donor type and conditioning? Well, so again, the matched sibling is clearly the gold standard. 97% of those patients are alive at 5 years, were alive at 5 years post-transplant. If you just look at this mismatched related, these are the haplocompatible donors who did not get any conditioning. They did the best, the next best, 79% were alive at 5 years, although unrelated donors or other related donors who didn't get T-cell depletion, they also had a very good survival of 74%. The group that didn't do well and was significantly different were the haplos that got conditioned, or the umbilical cord blood recipients who also got conditioned, and they had the poorest and significantly survival. What about survival in the young infants? So there were 68 children with SCID who were transplanted prior to 3.5 months of age. And basically, the bottom line is that regardless of how they were treated, they all did very well. And there was no statistical significance between the outcomes in any of these patients. And then finally, what about the patients with active infection at the time of transplant? So there were 106, so almost half of the children in this 240 patient cohort had active infection at the time of transplant. You can see that if they got a haplocompatible transplant with no conditioning, they had the best outcome. Again, the matched sibling was clearly the very best. And then if you compared it to any other type of donor that got conditioning, the results were very poor. And that was, again, highly statistically significant. So I'm now going to move on for the rest of the talk to just tell you about newborn screening for severe combined immunodeficiency disease. The basis of newborn screening is the measurement of T-cell receptor excision circles, or TRECs. And this is basically, I'll go through this quickly, but it's basically a product of the process of VDCA recombination, which is what happens in T cells and B cells as they begin the maturation process in either the thymus or in the bone marrow in developing the T cell receptor or the B cell receptor. And this is the example of the T cell receptor process. And here, just in this example, you have a V region that is going to, join with a J region, okay, these two black regions. And as part of that process, this piece of DNA in between gets cut out. And when it's cut out, it forms a circle. And these two parts of the circle form come together to form a signal joint. And using real-time PCR, you can quantitate the number of these circular pieces of DNA in the T cells in the blood. And you can do this in newborn babies by taking a small sample of blood spot from a Guthrie card, extracting the DNA. You can measure the TREX by PCR, and you get a very nice assay. That's the standard curve. So these are the best update that I can get. It's as of November 4th. But blue states, we didn't use blue and red in this example, but just the blue states are the states that are actively doing newborn screening. I guess this is purple here, are the states that should be, by the end of 2015, will also be actively screening. And whatever this color is, light green, there's eight of them. At this point, they've not expressed any desire to start newborn screening. So the ones we're working on, the one that we're really worried about is Arizona, because as some of you know, the Navajo Nation has a very high incidence of severe combined immunodeficiency disease. And unfortunately, while there is newborn screening there, some of these families have moved to Phoenix and other places in Arizona, and they're having SCID babies that are not being picked up by newborn screening. So this is a study that we initiated, the PIDTC initiated a couple of years ago, to look at what was the current national experience with newborn screening in the United States. And it involved the 10 states, I've listed them here, plus the Navajo Nation, that had been doing screening over a period of about 3 years. And there were 3 million infants that were screened during that time period in these states. 52 were diagnosed with typical or leaky SCID or Omenn syndrome. So they had SCID, and that's where we are now getting what we think is the most accurate estimate of the incidence of SCID of 1 per 58,000. You can see the range here. There were another 411 babies that were picked up with T-cell lymphopenia who did not have SCID. And about a third of them were associated with syndromes like CHARGE, like the George syndrome, like trisomy 21, that in fact turn out to have low TREC numbers at birth. There are about a third that were secondary types of T-cell lymphopenia, and then a third were unspecified. So this just gives you what we thought of prior to this study. So before SCID newborn screening, retrospective series in not only in the U.S. but in Europe all gave an incidence of SCID of about 1 per 100,000. And the most common form of SCID being the X-linked form, this interleukin common gamma chain, representing anywhere from 40 to 50% of all SCID patients. Well, this is what we think is really going on based on the study, prospective study of 3 million babies in the U.S. So the incidence is now 1.7 per 100,000, almost twice of what was currently thought. And the distribution is a lot different in some respects anyway. Certainly, the incidence of the X-linked form is now more like 19 or 20%. And interestingly, and surprisingly to many of us, the recombinase activating genes 1 and where's 2 here represent about 17% now of all SCID, whereas they represented about 2% in these retrospective series. So I think this was a very important study. Obviously, as we get more data as the number of states expand, some of this information may mature a little bit more, but I think it's looking pretty good right now. So I'm now going to just talk about California a little bit, California Newborn Screening Program. It started in about four and a half years ago. It was in August of 2010 when screening was started. And this is a running total, but it's out of date. So it's, I just have data right now as of September of 2014. There were 37 babies with SCID, 29 with the typical, 8 with leaky SCID. And this just shows the breakdown. I'm not going to go through it other than to point out that two things. One is that the X-linked form, it's pretty much similar. It's 24%. It's very comparable to what we saw with the national study. And the recombinase activating genes, number one, it was 16%. Number two was 5%. So it's also about the same as what we were what we're seeing with the national study. So they're definitely better represented. The other point I want to make is that we're still, even today, not identifying a genotype or genotypic cause for about a fifth of the patients with SCID who are being diagnosed. So I think there's still a lot of opportunity here for identifying new genes, novel genes, and understanding the immune system development. So now just to talk a little bit about the experience at UCSF, we have seen as of October, and so this number is out of date, but I didn't update this. I think this will give you an idea. Saw 25 babies at UCSF with SCID since 2010. This includes 3 from the Navajo Reservation through their newborn screening. So this is not all California. 5 have not yet been transplanted or are not going to, well, at least one is not going to be transplanted, or 3 of them aren't. 1 with a pretty bad or severe T-cell lymphopenia, also had macrocephaly, speech delay. Interestingly, because we weren't quite comfortable with moving forward with a transplant, we watched this baby on, put the baby on immunoglobulin supplementation, prophylactic antibiotics, and watched the baby for a few months. And as we repeated the T cell studies, they got better. And they got better to the point, and the baby was thriving. And we eventually stopped the prophylactic antibiotics, we stopped the gamma globulin, we immunized the baby, and the baby made normal antibody. So that child seems to be doing quite well. So there's also a message there that we have to, for some of these cases, if they're not really obvious, they don't have a genotype and they may have other features, that a little bit of caution before jumping to doing a transplant certainly indicated. 2 with ADA deficiency, we've referred to Dr. Cohn here for gene therapy. I think we have 2. Well, we want to get the second one into you anyway. And then 1 with leaky SCID is still being evaluated. And there's 1 with cartilage hair hypoplasia, or appears to have cartilage hair hypoplasia, but we can't identify a mutation. But that child is scheduled for a transplant in 2015. And then there are 20 that have gotten transplants. And I'll just show you quickly the how these babies, what the laboratory values were like. And I broke it down into the 16 with typical, 7 with leaky or Omenn, and then these two outliers, kind of the cartilage hair hypoplasia and the one with combined immunodeficiency disease. So you can see the very lowest numbers of TREX, a median of 0 here, were clearly the typical SCID. 56% had evidence of maternal cells at the time of diagnosis. You can see they had very low CD3 counts. The large majority had virtually no detectable CD3. And then PHA was also very low, as you'd expect. For the leaky, they also had pretty low TREX as well, and no evidence of maternal chimerism, somewhat higher CD3 counts, and a somewhat higher lymphocyte proliferation to phytohemagglutinin. And then the other two just also had some detectable CD3 and some PHA as well. And these are the genotypes for these 25 SCID babies. Again, 5 we didn't identify a genotype for. And then this is just the 20 that were transplanted. You can see that in the 14 typical SCID, we had the majority got haplocompatible transplants. There were 2 sibling donors and 2 matched unrelated donors. The age of transplant, the median age is 53 days, so we were able to make it before that 3.5 month goal or target. Conditioning, we didn't use conditioning in any of these patients. I mean, we didn't use chemotherapy in any. 11 got nothing, but 3 got some type of antibody serotherapy. But more for GVHD prophylaxis than anything else. And 13 of the 14 engrafted. The only one that didn't engraft, we've not yet identified a genotype on that baby. And that baby unfortunately developed disseminated cytomegalovirus, probably from either nursing or at the time of delivery. And the baby died of disseminated CMV before we could do anything other than the initial transplant. And then the leaky or Omenn, all but one got some form of conditioning. We're now looking at a half dose or a low dose, very low dose of targeted busulfan, and 2 of them got that, and 1 got sort of the standard dose of busulfan. The child with Omenn syndrome, and 4 or 5 engrafted. The only one that didn't, again, had an unknown genotype, had multiple congenital defects, and we actually retransplanted that patient with an unrelated donor that we had found, and that patient's fully, and some conditioning, and that patient's fully engrafted, doing well except for these terrible congenital defects. And then the cartilage hair hypoplasia got an unrelated donor and is doing quite well. We waited because that patient did not have as severe a T-cell defect, and so we felt comfortable waiting until the baby was a little older before exposing her to high-dose busulfan. And that's our overall survival, 95%. At 45 months. And this was the first child with severe combined immunodeficiency disease diagnosed in California by newborn screening. She had an IL-7 alpha receptor defect, got a haplocompatible transplant without any conditioning from her mother, and is fully reconstituted off all antibiotics, off immunoglobulin therapy, and this is really cute. And this is a child not from newborn screening, but it's kind of cute, and I just have to show it to you. But this is when I had more hair. So this is a number of years ago. And this baby was diagnosed at birth because, unfortunately, her older brother had presented to us with cytomegalovirus pneumonia and died during transplant. But we got her when she was, uninfected. Her mom here is, she's a flower child, still is, was the donor. Actually, she is. She runs a flower shop, literally. But she's still the, she was the donor, and we've got no conditioning. And then this kid has grown up. And this is the Valentine's Day card that she sent me last year, or a couple of years ago. And she's doing very well. I think she wants to go to medical school. So I just am going to end. Unfortunately, maybe it's good for me that Dr. Cohn had to leave. So I wanted to just summarize gene therapy, where we're at. What's the advantage of gene therapy? Well, obviously, you don't have to deal with an allogeneic transplant, so you don't have to deal with graft versus host disease. You don't have to worry about rejection because you're using the patient's own cells. And while in many cases you do have to do some conditioning to open up marrow niches, you don't have to give nearly as much as what you'd have to give for an allogeneic transplant. So the first truly successful gene therapy was for ADA deficiency, and what made it a success was giving low-dose busulfan. And this was first reported by the groups from Italy and Israel in Science magazine in 2002. The world experience is higher than this now. Probably Dr. Cohn could update this, but of the 40 that had been done, the 70% were successful. That means 12 went back on enzyme replacement therapy, but all survived. So there's been no mortality associated with that. And I think with the newer approaches that Don and others are using, this success rate is going to go up. And these are lentiviral constructs now that are being evaluated in the U.S. by Dr. Cohn, and then in England and in Italy. And then the gamma chain or X-linked form, the first major report was of 11 children from Paris. That was in New England Journal using autologous marrow, and they used a Mallony murine leukemia virus vector. And they were very successful in 10 of the 11 in getting the gene into T cells, and then maybe they got it into B cells and a little bit into NK cells, at least initially in their report. But unfortunately, less than 40% of those patients were able to come off IVIG. So similar to what we've seen with allogeneic transplant, without conditioning, you don't get B-cell reconstitution all the time, even with gene therapy. The bad news was that four of these patients developed T-cell ALL because of insertion of the vector near an oncogene, the LMO2 gene. And there were a total of 21 patients overall that were treated either in Paris or in London. 20 were successful. There was only that one failure, but one in London also developed leukemia. So a total of 5 out of 20 developed ALL, which I think everyone agreed was not an acceptable risk for this approach. And currently, there are several studies ongoing looking at the lentiviral constructs or a modified Mallony murine leukemia virus vector that appears to have a much lower risk for insertional mutagenesis. But I think we're just going to have to wait and see what the overall outcome is, since some of these patients didn't develop leukemia for several years after their gene therapy. And there's a question being raised whether some type of conditioning comparable to what's being used for ADA deficiency may be necessary even for these babies in order to achieve a more reliable B-cell reconstitution. And then there are preclinical studies in Paris and in San Francisco now for doing gene therapy for the recombinase activating gene and for the gene that encodes for Artemis deficiency. So in summary, I think I've shown you that SCID has multiple genetic causes and phenotypes. Transplant and gene therapy are really the only cures for this disorder. An HLA-matched sibling, from the standpoint of allogeneic transplant, gives you the best outcome. But alternative donors are also effective. And I think, especially in patients who are infected, a haplocompatible donor without conditioning would be the first consideration. There are clearly issues of conditioning in newborn babies. There's the question of toxicity versus T and B cell reconstitution. And if we're going to use conditioning, which we may end up having to use, or something that opens up marrow niches, then I think we need to identify the lowest dose of busulfan that will give us or achieve that goal. And there actually is a prospective study that we are planning through the PIDTC that will be a dose escalation, starting at a very low dose of busulfan and trying to determine what the minimal dose is that we need to use in order to achieve B-cell reconstitution. So we're hoping that that study will be starting in late 2015 or early 2016. Gene transfer for SCID, there's certainly the issue of insertional mutagenesis and the issue of marrow space in order to achieve B-cell reconstitution. And then I've told you about the PIDTC consortium and the studies that we're doing not only on SCID, but Wiskott-Aldrich and CGD. And I need to acknowledge a whole lot of people, of course, at UCSF, and particularly Jennifer Puck, who's really developed the TREC assay for newborn screening, and I think is the person who's responsible for newborn screen. The reason that we are doing it in California today, for sure, and in a growing number of states as well, and the funding for a lot of this work, and then of course the PIDTC. Sorry. This is another patient. This patient presented with terrible parainfluenza viral pneumonia, and this was her 3 years later. She got a transplant from her dad, and I had to show this because I saw her in clinic, and she's into Project Runway, if any of you watch that. So she was showing me her Project Runway stance. Anyway, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.